Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, we talk to the director behind the film adaptation of the memoir Fairyland. Then a huge exhibit has manga fans flocking to the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco. Today's show is about stories and the city of San Francisco. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. The film Fairyland is about a complicated, loving relationship between a father and daughter. It's a film adaptation of the memoir by Alicia Abbott. Poet Steve Abbott moves he and his young daughter, Alicia, across the country to San Francisco after his wife is killed in a car accident. He comes to the Bay Area in part to live as an openly gay man. Their relationship grows when Alicia returns home from college to take care of her dad, because he contracted the AIDS virus. The movie begins in the 1970s. In this clip, actor Scoot McNairy, who plays Steve, talks about his big move with his mother-in-law, played by Gina Davis.
So, California.
I know a few people out there in San Francisco, and I thought I could get more work as a writer.
Have you given any more thought to Janet's offer to raise Alicia? Alicia gets along well with her cousins. She's still young, you know. It's not too late for her to have a real family.
She has a real family, Anne.
You know what I mean.
Andrew Durham is originally from Palo Alto. He wrote and directed Fairyland. Sofia Coppola is one of the film's producers. What's really uncanny is that Andrew and Alicia Abbott had similar experiences with their fathers around the same time. I spoke with Andrew about these parallels and how he felt making this film, which is his first. Andrew Durham, welcome.
Thank you, Janae, for having me. I'm super happy to be here.
I am so excited to talk to you for so many reasons, and I cannot wait to dig into this conversation. And first of all, congratulations. This is your directorial debut, Andrew. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is. It's long in the making, as I was a student filmmaker. I went to film school, and before that I made movies as a little kid, but I always knew I wanted to work in the movie business. It just took a while for me to find exactly what I wanted to do in it, and then also find the right story to tell. So I'm super excited that I have this story to tell, and this is my first film.
Yeah, and you've worked as a producer, you've worked in, you know, so many different roles in film behind the scenes. You're a photographer, you are an artist.
Either that, or I'm, you know, I have a short attention span.
And you are from the Bay.
Yes, I grew up down on the peninsula in Palo Alto. And that's where I went to high school. And then I graduated and moved down to Los Angeles to go to film school. But my roots are deeply in the Bay Area.
Yeah. And so the film takes place in the 1970s and 80s. And which is around the time you were living up here in the Bay. I know you're based in LA now. What was it like growing up in Palo Alto back then?
I think that being a college town, specifically Palo Alto, was a fantastic place as a young person because it seemed so diverse and it seemed so filled with opportunities and there were so many different things going on considering it was a suburb. You know, I think Stanford just being there added a very certain type of energy. And so back in the 70s and 80s, before a lot of the big tech invasion happened, and it was a really unique place. We had all of those regular things that kids in the suburb have, you know. And there was also this element that was so cool, especially as a teenager. We had a lot of revival movie theaters, you know, that would show old films, or art houses that showed foreign films, independent films. Like, they were every few blocks. And so having access to those kind of movies, you know, I think really shaped my language a little bit as a filmmaker, seeing a lot of foreign films and independent films at such a young age. I mean, we would have to actually either get on the bus or get our parents to drive us to Mountain View or Redwood City if we wanted to see a blockbuster, like a big movie, you know, Jaws or Star Wars or something. We had to leave town. Otherwise, we were all watching, you know, Harold and Maude.
So I want to talk about Fairyland. Tell me how you got connected to the book and this project.
The book was, actually sent to a dear friend of mine and producer on the film, Sofia Coppola, who I've known for 30 something years. We've kind of grown up together as young artists in Los Angeles. We met in the early 90s and we made a lot, you know, we made short films together. We did art projects together. And she was sent the book by Alicia Abbott's publisher as a possible person to adapt the memoir into a screenplay and direct the film. Alicia Abbott, the author of the memoir, is a huge fan of Sophia's work and thought Sophia would be perfect for this. And Sophia and I share a lot of, you know, when she's thinking about ideas for movies or I'm thinking about ideas for different things, we think, we share our thoughts. And she sent me the book and said, you know, I've got this book. It came to me. I was really captivated by the photograph on the cover of this little girl and her father taken in Golden Gate Park. And the story is so beautiful, but I just don't know whether it's my story to tell. Sophia knew that I also grew up with a gay father. And when my parents got divorced and my dad moved to San Francisco, my brother and I would spend a lot of our time with my dad and all his friends in the city. And so much in the memoir is about Alicia sort of navigating this balancing act between, you know, her friends at school and then her dad and all his friends. And I really related to that. And Sophia thought I could relate to that. And also, you know, when the AIDS crisis hit San Francisco, I was in the middle of that. I had to, you know, I sort of dropped my life and moved up to the city to take care of my father during the last year of his life. And both my father and Alicia Abbott's father, Steve Abbott, died in 1992. And I just think that having those shared experiences made Sophia realize that perhaps I would be a better person to tell this story, just coming to it with some real personal experiences and right. some honesty about the situation. So
that's amazing that your stories were so parallel. And it's funny, I wonder if your dad and Steve Abbott, if they ever crossed
paths. I know,
paths.
Right? I wondered that too. And it's like, I've sort of gone, I was given a wonderful opportunity from Alicia Abbott to read Steve's journals, which are all in the San Francisco Public Library. And that's what she based her memoir on so much of it, because she was obviously too young to remember the very early years. But I would go through his journals and I would read them line by line to try and figure out, oh, was he ever in the same circle as my dad? Were there any way that these paths would cross? I mean, there were thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of gay men that migrated to San Francisco in the 70s during the gay lib movement. So who knows if their paths ever crossed, but part of me is hoping that they'd had a conversation at a bar one night or something, or at a party. That would be amazing. They're roughly the same age and they were both in the city, different sort of worlds. My dad was an art dealer and a museum curator, and he probably didn't hang out so much in sort of the hippie poet world of the Haight-Ashbury as much, but I still hope mm-hmm. that their paths cross, because San Francisco back then was a pretty diverse place and it was an intersection for a lot of different types of people. I remember as a kid going to parties with my dad and seeing the mix of all these grown-ups, you know, and all these different types of people, from the, you know, the hippies of the Haight-Ashbury to the gay men of the Castro to the blue-blooded high society people of Nob Hill. You know, they were all commingling. So it was kind of fascinating to see that. So maybe, you never know.
Now, did Alicia Abbott, did she write the screenplay with you?
No, I wrote it by myself. It was the first screenplay I had written and obviously the first book I'd ever adapted into a screenplay. So she had the trust in me to do that. Which was pretty amazing. You know, when Sophia and I went out to meet Alicia in Boston and convince her that I should direct this film and not Sophia, at first I think she was a little apprehensive, but then when she heard about our similar histories, I think she was quite comfortable, and then she said, all right, do it, go for it.
If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with director Andrew Durham. His film is Fairyland. It's out in theaters now, and it will be streaming in November. But let's actually just talk about these characters and these people.
And the relationship. So actors Emilia Jones and Scoot McNairy, they play father and daughter, or daughter and father, Alicia and Steve. They were really great on screen. And so Alicia and Steve's relationship is so complex. And as I was watching, part of me understood why, you know, he wanted to move across the country to San Francisco and live his openly gay life. And on the other hand, a part of me found him selfish and irresponsible, because sometimes he put men and partying in his writing before his daughter. He did drugs around her, but he took care of her. He raised her. He could have left her with her grandparents. And you mentioned this earlier about just some of the issues and the feelings that come up. You maybe share some sentiments about your relationship with your father. And I'm seeing the same thing with Alicia and Steve. What are your thoughts on their relationship and how it's conveyed in this film?
What I love about the memoir is she brings all of these issues up, but there's never once any sort of judgment in her writing. And that really resonated with me. And I think that was what I was excited about trying to do in this film, is to sort of share these situations as honestly as possible, bringing in some of my own thoughts on this, which I'll talk about in a second, but making sure that nothing was black or white, that it was like, I was trying to make this thing so sort of non-binary when it comes to human situations, because we have a tendency in literature and film and storytelling to make sure that we have a good and a bad, a right and a wrong, you know? There's got to be somebody evil. And I remember actually when I was sort of taking the script around and trying to get investors and financing and people like that interested in studios, a common note was he's not a good enough parent. You need a very positive role model for gay parenting. He's too flawed. So that was one big note I got. The other note was the grandmother's not mean enough. She needs to be a villain. We really need to see her trying to take the kid away, and we need to see Steve be a great parent and prove her wrong. And so these were very sort of, I don't know, predictable notes to me. I think we've seen this kind of narrative before. I mean, I'm glad that people want to show positive queer role models. I think that's great. But that was not necessarily the story that Alicia Abbott was telling. Hers was a little bit more complicated, and hers seemed more based in reality to me. And now that the film is out and people are seeing it, it's so nice to have people come up and say, thank you so much for making the grandmother not a villain. That's just showing that she actually really loved her daughter and she was going to be patient, and she had concerns like they would be, but you didn't take sort of the typical easy target route with her. And thank you for showing a parent who messes up and then tries to, you know, correct themselves. And thank you for showing a teenager who is also flawed, who makes mistakes and who says terrible things that teenagers do, and that teenagers aren't always right, you know? Right. All sorts of across the spectrum of different things that I'm so glad that we stuck with. And one thing I kind of wanted to address, Janae, is that you touched on a little bit there about Steve and his sort of flamboyant lifestyle and his drug use. And I've talked about this with a few other people in some interviews, but I understood this much later in life, which I didn't really get when I was a kid. But my dad and so many guys that sort of grew up in the 50s that came out in the 1970s, they grew up in very sort of, well, the country was a different place than obviously. It was the 1950s, and they were all very closeted and they were all very suppressed. And they did not have that kind of natural adolescence that so many of their peers were going through during junior high and high school. And so they sort of had a false adolescence, and they suppressed so much of that, you know? And it wasn't until they were sort of embraced in the gay lib movement in cities like New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco in the 1970s that they were able to actually come out and live an honest sort of adolescence, for lack of, I keep repeating this word, but you know, that sort of coming of age And that's what I loved in the book too, was it shared this parallel coming of age story. So right as Alicia was sort of growing up and coming into her own, so was her father, because he wasn't able to do that at such a young age. And I remember as a kid visiting my dad and his friends, and you know, and they were wild and they were partying kind of like my friends were partying in high school. And I was like, huh, look at this. And they're going out late at night and they're dancing and they're having all this fun. And I was like, I don't think I understood the term arrested development back then, but I definitely was aware that something was going on. And then I realized, like, you know what, they're finally able to go through something that they weren't able to do when they were younger.
You know, later on, there's a scene where Steve asks his daughter if he's been a good father. Let's hear a clip of that.
Do you think I was a good parent?
Yeah, of course you were. You are. Why would you ask that?
I worry that you questioned some of the choices I made. Look, I didn't really know how to be a single parent. I just didn't want you to be raised the way that I was raised. My childhood was a series of boundaries and punishments. That kind of thing can really cripple a person. So, if I was sometimes a failure as a parent, just know that these were noble failures and that I always tried to do what was right for you.
You know, Andrew, I'm thinking about what you said earlier. Steve and your dad wilded out to live more freely, maybe didn't make the best choices, but it was the right choices, what they knew at the time. And I was just thinking about that Maya Angelou quote, you know, when you know better, you do better. And also too, I was also thinking about how this all goes back to, for many parents, that, you know, they're just doing the best they can.
Yeah. I mean, when my parents got divorced and my father moved to San Francisco, we stayed down in the suburbs with my mom. So it wasn't the exact or situation that Alicia had, that she was raised by her single dad, but my brother and I were raised by our single mom. And she was somebody who thought she was going to get married. She was gonna have kids. She was gonna have a husband who supported her. My mother also a product of the 50s. This is what mm-hmm. was supposed to happen. And then all of a sudden her husband comes out of the closet and moves away, and she's left with two kids. And he's not only sort of like finding himself emotionally and sexually and all of that, but he's also reinventing himself. Sort of, he was an accountant. He quit all that and wanted to work in the arts in San Francisco and be an art dealer and an antique dealer and all of this stuff. So he was kind of starting from scratch there. So it wasn't like my mom could really rely on him for much financial support. Like, he was figuring it out. It was almost like relying on a college, your kid going, graduating college and expecting them to support you. No, they're just going to figure out what they're doing. So they do the best they can do. And a theme that I hope people get out of this movie is that there's more than one type of good parent. For I'm not a parent, but I have a lot of friends that are raising their kids, and they get stuck sometimes in this frame of mind that, well, to be a good parent, you have to check off certain boxes.
Right.
But you don't.
I mean, and that's interesting too, what you just said, because I'm thinking about the expectations, right? What are the expectations? I'm thinking of both of them. They were dealing with the societal expectations of how they're supposed to be. You know, Alicia's dealing with how she's supposed to be as a girl, how her hair is supposed to look, because he couldn't do her hair, right? But he did the best he can. How was he expected to be as a man, right? I'm sure he was carrying that. And like these expectations of how people are supposed to be. And that's why I really like the film, because people didn't fit in a box. Like you said, it wasn't black or white. It was gray. There doesn't always have to be a villain. I mean, people are complex. That's why I said sometimes I was like critical of him, of Steve, but I also had compassion. And for Alicia too, because I was critical of Alicia too. And it's funny because Alicia sometimes was selfish, right? As when she was younger, she was selfish. She was ashamed. There was a time she was ashamed of her father being gay because of his expectations, like what she thought a home was supposed to be, a family was supposed to be, and the peer pressures from friends who were homophobic. So it's really, I just like films like that, where it just really shows just how layered it is to be human. And it's not cut and dry fairy tale. I know this is fairy land, but it's not cut and dry, you know, fairy tale, good, bad. It's, you know, it's in between. It's people being human. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with director Andrew Durham. His film is Fairyland. It's out in theaters now, and it will be streaming in November. So you shot some of this film in San Francisco, and I know you, like, again, you have worked behind the scenes on different films. What is it like shooting in San Francisco? Like, what's unique about it?
San Francisco is as much of a character in this story as Steve and Alicia are. So,
absolutely.
I have a fabulous local producer, Megan Carlson, who lives in San Francisco, and she really figured out a way for us to do this. And, you know, we also had a very tight budget. So we had to think economically of how we were going to do this. So the film, we shot in the city proper only 2 days. And then the next day we shot everything we needed to do in Golden Gate Park. All the interiors that you see were actually shot right across the bay in Vallejo.
Oh.
Vallejo is a wonderful little town, and it was, you know, sort of built around the same time San Francisco was. So there's a lot of the similar architecture. And in Vallejo, there is a place called Mare Island, which is an old military base.
Yeah.
And on that military base, there are several abandoned, well, some aren't abandoned, some have companies in them, and I think one even has a wine tasting room in them. But they're these old Navy captain mansions, again, built around the same time as a lot of the row houses in San Francisco. And we just, or Megan found these and thought, well, why don't we shoot our interior apartment scenes in one of these old mansions? Oh, I love Vallejo. Shoot in Vallejo. If anyone out there wants a great place to shoot, it's a really wonderful community, and it's got all sorts of great resources and wonderful location. So,
yeah, because I thought it was still San Francisco, so you fooled me. Okay, so Andrew, again, this is such an amazing film. This is your you know, directorial debut. You wrote the screenplay. You adapted it from a book. I know that was not easy. And for your first film, you directed Gina Davis.
All right.
Oh my awesome. Gosh. Yes.
I've always been a huge fan of Gina Davis. She's just one of those actors who just always stuck with me. And I don't think there's really been anyone quite like her since. You know, from the first time I saw her in Tootsie, just to everything she's done afterwards, and there's just something so cool about her. And it was one of those whims where, you know, you've got this script, you're trying to attach actors, and I just said to we have a wonderful casting team, I said, can we just send the script to her? Just, you know, why not? What do I got to lose? I mean, what's gonna happen? And she read it. Apparently she liked it, because then I got a call from like her people, and they said, well, how many days do you need her for? And I was like, thinking, oh my God, this is going to happen. I bet I can do it. So I said, one, could she just fly up to San Francisco and we'll do it all in one day? And so we did it that way. And she said, yes. And so the script must have resonated with her, and she liked it. And, you know, she has a wonderful foundation about gender equality in media. If nobody knows about, they should look it up, because it's all about making sure that just as many female voices and characters are represented, especially in children's stories, as there are boys. So I really have been impressed by that, and I really respect that. So that was another reason why I was like, you know what, I got to get this lady on board. So I said I could do it in one day, and she flew up, and she was such a good sport. So we shot all of her scenes in one day. You know, and you watch the film, you're thinking, well, she was just on the phone, but really there were some big scenes. You know, she had that.
I mean, how many people can say that the first movie they directed had Gina Davis?
Cool, right?
So, I mean, just to let folks know, Gina Davis plays Alicia's grandmother, Steve's mother-in-law. I mean, so to just kind of play it down like, oh, she was, you know, she was on the phone. She was doing more than on the phone. But I think if I directed a movie and Gina Davis was in it, I don't care if she just,
I know, right? Just
if she just said hello and hung up.
Right? No,
I had Gina Davis in my first film.
I'm just saying, we were really lucky about that. And again, I think it goes back to Alicia Abbott's story. I think she wrote a beautiful memoir, and it's a story that resonates with people. It was the same with Adam Lambert. You know, he's like...
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because he plays Steve's boyfriend, and I did not recognize him at all. I did not recognize him at all at first. And this was his first dramatic role, right?
Yes, this was his first movie. And again, this was somebody who, you know, he was in the middle of, like, touring with Queen, and... this was another situation. I need you for, I think, like a day. Can you come in and do all this in a day? And the story resonated with him. He also has childhood memories of relatives that lived in the Castro in San Francisco, and he would spend time there, and has really colorful memories of that whole era. And so he wanted to be a part of it. He's so good in it, too. He comes in with such heart. He just rolled in, and the chemistry he had with Scoot was like a home run for me. And so I was really happy to have...
You know, something I didn't mention is grief, right? Because there's grief with Steve of losing his wife and Alicia losing her mother. And then there's also grief, too, because he has AIDS. So there's grief in there. And how does that drive their lives and maybe some of their actions, too? And that's another reason why... you may judge Steve, but also too, there's this compassion too, because he is grieving. So how does that drive Alicia's and Steve's lives and their relationship?
A great question. You know, I've done so many interviews for this film, and that topic, even though that seems to be an underlying theme in the film, as it was in the memoir, but it's something that hasn't really been asked. I think that, grief obviously is about loss. And so, you know, when you're grieving someone, you're mourning the loss of somebody, but you're also addressing just loss and life and the shortness of life. And which I think for me, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, it then reverts back to living life to the fullest. And you can look at Steve, you know, losing his wife and realizing how fragile life is. And perhaps when you're confronted with that, how you need to embrace life more than ever. I think that when my father got, my own father got sick. You know, I was just in my 20s when my dad died. It was a kind of a wake-up call for me. And I think that grief manifested in really pursuing my dreams more than ever and really living large more than ever. And that's sometimes a weird gift you get from close ones that pass, is that they're a reminder that you're not going to be around forever, and you need to really step up your game and really live life and not put stuff off. You know, in the story, Alicia Abbott decides she wants to go to France to study abroad. And this is something her father had always wanted for her. When you read the memoir, you understand a little bit that she kind of saw what was coming down the pike a little bit with her dad. We touch on this a little bit in the film. She comes home from college and she sees the obituaries in the newspaper. Yeah. She sees the young man sick in the hospice. It's like, you know, maybe it seems selfish to leave and embrace this dream she has when it's possible this could be happening to her father, but also it's a reminder, live life.
Well, Andrew, for your first film, you did a great job, and I hope you make more movies, because if this is your first film, I can only imagine what you got cooking.
Thank you for the words of acknowledgement and inspiration, and you reminded me to get back to writing. So,
thank you so much, Andrew, for your time.
Thank you, Janae. This is a real pleasure.
That was Andrew Durham, director of the film Fairyland. See it in theaters now, and look out for it to hit streaming platforms in November. Coming up, a major manga exhibit has landed in San Francisco, and whether you love manga or don't know much about it, you don't want to miss this next interview. Keep it locked right here. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds. Sound Show with Janae Darden. If you have kids or teens in your life who like comics, chances are they're into manga. Actually, you may be a manga fan. In recent years, the Japanese comics and graphic novels have become more popular here in the U.S. According to the publishing data source BookScan, in 2023, nearly half of all graphic novels sold in the U.S. were manga. We're talking over 21 million books. Well, there's a huge exhibit all about this Japanese style of storytelling, and it's called The Art of Manga, and you can see it at the De Young Museum in San Francisco until the end of January 2026. With more than 600 drawings, this is the first major exhibition of manga in North America. Nicole Coolidge-Rumanier curated the exhibit. She's a professor of Japanese art and culture at the University of East Anglia, Norwich, in the UK, and we talked about the history of manga and how it's been used in social and political movements. And by the way, Nicole loves manga. Here's our interview. Professor Nicole Coolidge-Rumanier, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, this exhibit is incredible. I'm new to manga. So for people who haven't, you know, read manga or don't even know much about it, definitely you'll learn so much here. And you are so enthusiastic about manga. Tell us when you were first introduced to manga and what drew you to it.
Well, I've always liked drawings and visual narratives. Even when I was a young kid, I loved reading Tintin. I particularly liked Asterix, and I was really drawn to anything that I could read and that was comic form. But I had the chance to go to Japan when I was 18, and I was formally introduced to manga, and it's been just an obsession since.
What is it about the artistry that you like, or the storytelling?
What it is, and it's different than Marvel Comics. So when I was introduced to manga, it opened up a new world for me. What I do at night is I read manga. It's thrilling. I read manga to de-stress. I read manga when I have free time, when I'm on an airplane. It's not just something I like. It's a passion for me. And I think that many people are like that. The reason is because it's immersive. So some people watch videos, some people like film. For me, I love holding something in my hand and you enter the manga. They are sound effects that are drawn into the manga. You almost get this kind of sensory feeling. It appeals to a different part of your brain than text. It's the visual part, the other side of your brain. And so it's almost a wraparound story that you can control. In an anime, the pace is by the film. You have to go along with it. But with a manga, you can control it, how fast you turn the page, how slow you turn the page. And what's so amazing about it, because of the way it's drawn, is that you reread it and reread it. And the third time you reread it, you think, wow, I didn't see this before. So it's like a gift that keeps on giving. Last thing I want to say is manga is about the zeitgeist. So manga is about stories that matter at that moment. So it's speaking to all different stories that matter. And so you learn so much from manga. You know, right now there's about aging, about robots, about all of that. And there's manga for that. There's a manga for literally everything. And that's what's so thrilling about it.
Okay, so definitely, as we see, you're very passionate about manga. So according to Grand Review Research, manga has pulled in $1.1 billion in the U.S. market alone. That's just the U.S. market because it is huge globally. Huge, huge, millions and millions and millions and millions of copies of manga have been sold around the world. When did manga become popular in the U.S.? And did anime have a role in that?
Well, you're spot on. It definitely did. But it's interesting. I think manga first became popular in the US in the 80s. I'm pretty sure about that. And we have a couple of people. One person who was involved in this exhibition is named Fred Schott. And in the 80s and early 90s, he published some books, Manga, and, you know, really introducing manga in a really authentic way to America. But also there's another man named Kurt Hassler, who is now head of Yen Press and Kadokawa International. And he was at that point at Borders, and he started introducing manga into malls. He took a new vision of manga and brought it out and popularized it in places in malls in Alabama or wherever. And he really had a great strategy, and that helped catch hold. But the anime also is very important. Manga has been very well received in Europe. And a lot of that is because there's a lot of anime in Italy and in France and in Spain from the 70s onward. Disney was quite expensive to purchase, so instead they went to the Japanese anime. And so you see Europeans that have grown up with these characters, and then they love the manga form. And so Europe had a bit of an advantage over America. But you know what you said a little bit before that was so spot on, is that manga is really popular in Saudi Arabia. It's popular in Indonesia. It's popular in Southeast Asia. It's popular in Thailand. It's really popular in Taiwan. You know, and what's so amazing is it's really global. But what I've found out recently in creating this exhibition is that the same manga is popular in Saudi Arabia that is in America. And so it's almost as if it's become a universal language. And I think that's really important. It's a way of people communicating with each other. You know, you can be friends, you have a common language, you connect with people of all different cultures, and you can talk about One Piece, and it has meaning.
One Piece, which is a popular manga story. Mm-hmm.
Yes, in fact, One Piece is fabulous. It's a story that is the most popular manga and sold the most number of volumes. It's broken the Guinness Book of World Records. At one point, there were 7 million copies printed each week. Oh, 6 million, sorry, 6 million copies printed each
wow.
week of distribution of the magazines. Its readership in Japan has gone down on paper, but it stayed the same or risen digitally.
I like how you expanded on the international appeal of manga and how it impacts, or just the connection too with Americans. And I'm thinking too of this younger generation who has social media, and so they have more access to just global entertainment. When I was growing up, I grew up in the 80s, and as far as anime, I didn't get exposed to a lot of anime. I'm thinking of Voltron, like I remember like that, which was a huge cartoon back when I was growing up. Like, you know, that was anime, and I watched Voltron like religiously. That was like that's one of my favorite cartoons. So, you know, I can see the appeal of manga. But so this exhibit, again, is incredible. How did this exhibit come to life at the De Young? How did this happen?
So what happened with this exhibition is that I did another exhibition at the British Museum in 2019, and that was more of a historical overview of the phenomena of manga. And that was good in and of itself, but I didn't feel that I really got to the heart of the actual production of manga, the artist's brilliance, and we didn't have a chance to do any deep dives. So I was always a little bit sad about that. But the director of the De Young, Tom Campbell, came and visited the exhibition, and he said, could we have this at the De Young? And that exhibition was just too hard to move, but I told him I would make one for him. and then it was about, I think maybe 5 years or really 4 years in intensive, and then 3 years really intensive in production. And we really honed it down, and we decided on 10 artists and 8 deep dives. The exhibition has 689 objects, and that's a lot of objects, but it doesn't feel like a lot, because what we've done is we've focused on deep dives on 8 of the artists, and we present 2 other kind of the pillar artists, and then 8 deep dives all in their own room. And we have narrative flows of 4 to 5 titles each. So you actually are reading the manga on the walls from the original drawings, and you can see the different styles, the different way the artists work. And some artists go from analog hand drawing to digital. Some are completely analog, and some, particularly one, is completely digital. So you can see different delivery methods, different styles. And by the end of the exhibition, everyone will be fluent in manga.
I'm working on it. So one thing, too, I like about the exhibition is that when you read manga, you read it from right to left. And that's how the exhibition is set up. You go
yes.
from right to left, which I thought was really, really unique.
And it's really important to right to left, just as you said, and it goes from upper right to lower left. So you're reading it almost diagonally. And in Japan, manga is normally drawn as 2 pages. So you have a spread. So when you open the book, there are 2 pages. So it's not one page, one page. It's the spread that is important. So 2 pages together form a composition, and your eyes can read it incredibly quickly. So reading manga is much more quick than reading any text. And Japanese textbooks oftentimes now are in manga. So school textbooks are in manga because people can absorb it probably 300 times faster than you do in reading, if you were reading the text itself.
So you said like these textbooks, they have like the art, the manga art in them?
They are literally manga. They've turned the history textbooks, the science textbooks, the medical textbooks, all of these, they've turned them into manga and approved by the local prefectures and the government. In fact, the government uses manga to talk about compliance and legal registration. It also interesting, companies like Hermes have manga of their histories, and Toyota, they'll have a manga of their company history. And there's a manga for Japanese economics to understand Japanese economics. Manga is just a very quick way of absorbing information that's important in different types of parts of your brain. So it's visceral.
Why do you go from right to left when you read? So Americans, when we read books, we go left to right. We, you know, as far as turning the pages, and it's opposite in Japan with manga. Is that how the Japanese read, or is it just with the manga?
Exactly. Can I just tell you a quick little story about that?
Yeah.
I created with a manga artist, Hoshino Yukinobu, a manga of the British Museum. It's called Professor Munakata's British Museum Adventure. And I love my mother, and I would send her what I do, and I sent it to her. And she got back to me saying, "Dear, I normally like what you do, but I really don't understand this." And I said, "Mom, did you read it from right to left?" And she said, "Oh."
And, if you read it the other way, you won't understand it.
So she liked it after that. Japanese language is a right to left. And why you have to read the manga that way is because it's drawn that way. So for example, if you have a PowerPoint slide in Japan, you know, when you put a slide up on the screen, in America, the most important image will be on the left side because it's what everyone's looking at. In Japan, the most important image is on the right side because that's what everyone's looking at. And so by doing that, the right side is what is the action now, and moving towards the left side is moving towards the future for Japan. So if you have someone facing the left, that means they're going forward. If they're facing the right, they're going back or looking back. So it's the composition tells you a lot about the story. And there are these things in manga called manpu. They're manga grammar. And once you start to learn the manga grammar, which you will looking at the exhibition, then you read it much more quickly and it makes sense.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Professor Nicole Coolidge-Rumanier. She's the curator of the exhibit Art of Manga and is currently running at the De Young Museum in San Francisco until January 25th, 2026. So you mentioned earlier about, you know, how the government uses manga and using it in education, or just, you know, I guess government laws to inform people, to teach people things in Japan. And I was looking at the diversity of the exhibit. And so the art explores a variety of themes. Manga does. And as you mentioned earlier, so many stories about manga, you know, manga stories. And so some of the themes explored are friendship, gender, identity. And there was one artist, Tagami Gengoro?
Gengoro.
Okay, Gengoro. Tagami Gengoro.
Yes, perfect.
And he draws erotic gay manga. So I wasn't expecting to see erotic manga. How has a manga evolved to be more inclusive and diverse?
That is really, really an important question. Thank you for that. And manga is, because it's the zeitgeist, whatever is in the consciousness gets drawn. So for example, there's something in Japan that is hikikomori, which is people that are kind of isolate themselves or agoraphobic, you know, and don't come out of their homes. There are mangas for that. You know, there's manga for aging. There's one, Komi Can't Communicate, and it's about just not being able to, you know, speak, or, you know, there's manga for people who are challenged in hearing, all sorts of manga. Manga is very important, as we touched on earlier, about education. So it teaches people about things and you kind of get new experiences about that. We have one, Drops of God, that is a manga about wine and people learn about wine. But with Tagami Gengoro, it's really important. And manga can actually shift hearts and minds. So Tagami Gengoro started off as an erotic artist with some pretty racy but fabulously drawn and really compelling manga. Then he did a kind of a break takeaway manga that was more of a story manga called My Brother's Husband. And it was about twin boys who lost their parents. They were obviously traumatized and very, very close. One came out to the other, and one of the twins was just couldn't take it, and they became estranged. And the one twin that was gay immigrated to Canada, married a buff guy, Mike Flanagan, and they had a fabulous relationship. Everything was good, but tragically, he died. So the manga starts when Mike Flanagan travels to Japan to meet the estranged twin because they're in mourning. And the story starts there, and it's basically just about them, the twin who is a little bit repressed, and he has a five-year-old girl that he's raising, and he obviously has trauma because he's separated from his wife, and he's a single father, and then he's forced to take in his brother's husband, and this is just really challenging for him. And the story is about the few weeks that they are together, and within it, you start to see the process of the estranged twin's mind shifting. It's not just a happy, happy story. It's actually going into the psychology and what happens and him actually understanding that maybe he made a mistake in estranging his brother and maybe he missed something. But what was really important about that manga was then it was taken up by NHK, which is the public broadcasting of Japan. And it was done as a series in the morning, every morning for 15 minutes. There was My Brother's Husband. And what that did in Japan was it shifted the way that people could come out. It actually made it okay to come out. Being diverse sexually has always been okay in Japan, but you don't come out. And this actually shifted and people started changing their minds on things. So manga can affect change. And this one did.
And speaking of manga affecting change, we're seeing manga in protest movements. And so again, that very popular manga One Piece, which is popular amongst Gen Z, and there's a troop of pirates. They're called the Straw Hats Pirates, these characters, and in the story they challenge a corrupt government. And so their flag, the pirates' flag, have been hanging in various sites of protests around the world, and I understand it's become a symbol of defiance that resonates with a lot of Gen Z readers. Can you talk about that? I thought that was really interesting too. That's the power of art, you know.
The power of art and the power of story. And what's really important about manga is while you have these stories, it's the characters. You start to live through these characters and you start to identify and you experience the worlds with them. And Oda Eiichiro, the mastermind behind One Piece, has tapped into the national consciousness. It's almost been 40 years of this story, and it is brilliant. I've read it twice, and that's not a small feat because it's 115, you know, it's 100 number of volumes, and it's, you know, thousands of chapters, but it is fabulous and it's gripping. And he talks about all sorts of things throughout the story, and he creates these worlds. So he's not just challenging one world, he's challenging corruption, all sorts of different types of corruption. And the story basically is about Luffy. And Luffy is a young boy who, you know, is a little bit on his own, and he gets his friends around and he gathers his team and his crew, the Straw Hats, and they have all sorts of adventures together. So it's you can't choose your parents, but you can choose your friends. And it's about friendship. And for Luffy, the most important thing is freedom, to have friends, to be with your friends, and to have enough food to eat. So that if you've those three things and you're okay, and their big adventure is to find what is One Piece. Now, is One Piece money? Is One Piece treasure? Is One Piece an idea? What is it? No one knows, but he's searching for it. And it's about the adventure, sticking with his friends. And it's not that Luffy is so strong that he can overcome anything. It's not. He overcomes all of this with the help of his friends. Each one is individual, but they contribute to the whole. And so you start to identify with a particular character. You just kind of get drawn in and excited about it. So I can completely see why it's used in protest, but it's also, it's not just a negative thing. It's a positive thing. It's life affirming. Luffy really is a universal sign. So I hope people won't think of it as a negative thing. I think I want them to think of it as an empowerment, and empowerment to be free, to have enough to eat, and to be able to express yourself.
you know, there's so many other unique features in the museum, in this exhibit. So, like, there's the Japanese toy vending machines. There's a reading room with a ton of manga books for people to enjoy. I thought that was really neat. And it's nice and quiet.
And it's free for anyone to come in.
Right. It's free. But don't take the books. It's free to read the books and leave them there. I really encourage people to look at the printing press installation. That was amazing.
Yes. One piece only. It's about how manga is made, literally.
Yeah, it's really, really, I love printing presses as a journalist, and I love newspapers, but to see, and books, so I just thought that was really, really neat. You see these giant printing rolls, so I really encourage people to check that out. And my last question, you are so passionate about this exhibit, you are so passionate about manga. What do you want people to take away from this exhibit?
I want them to take away the power of the line to tell narrative. So literally, these artists are brilliant, and each one is different. And so you get a chance to see each single artist and see how they tell stories. But to have that experience close up with the actual physical drawings that are the origin point for manga, and you see the line quality. When they're hand-drawn, you can't erase them. What's drawn is drawn and you're there. And with digital, you can do a little erasing, but you just see the fluidity of the line. It's like Leonardo da Vinci's drawings. They are amazing. So I want people to realize that this is an art, that these artists are passionate and amazing, and they're doing it. They're working every week, every day on their art, and they've taken it to an incredible extreme. And by looking at these originals, you will never see manga again when you hold it in the same way. You can, when you're reading one piece in your hand after you've seen Oda Ichiro's hand drawings, it takes on new meaning, and it's thrilling.
Well, Professor Nicole Coolidge-Rumineer, thank you for the exhibit. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your enthusiasm.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Nicole Coolidge-Rumineer is a curator of the Art of Manga. The exhibit is currently running at the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco until January 25th of 2026. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you, as always, for tuning in. And also thank you to those who attended and performed at our Creepy Tales event. We had a nice crowd and a good time. Our next Sights and Sounds event will be the week of Valentine's Day, so make sure you put that on your calendar, and we'll keep you posted on that in the very, very, very near future. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.